Good evening. Thank you for your patience. I think it will be rewarded momentarily. My name is Michael Castro, and it's a great pleasure to welcome all of you to this special edition of the River Styx at Duff's poetry series featuring the South African poet, playwright, and novelist Brayton Breytenbach and the Somalian novelist Nuruddin Farah. We wish to thank the International Writers Center of Washington University for including the River Styx at Duff's poetry series as part of the historical Writer in Politics conference taking place all of this week. We are confident that the center's directors, William Gass and Lauren Cuoco, chose to hold the reading here, knowing full well the history of River Styx in this city as a community-based organization long devoted to providing forums for writers of wide-ranging perspectives, many of them rarely heard in the Midwest, and many of them directly political in implication and application. Allen Ginsberg, Dennis Brutus, Carolyn Forché, Gary Snyder, Toni Morrison, James Baldwin, Marilyn Hacker, Raul Salinas, Simon Ortiz, Joy Harjo, Ishmael Reed, Maurice Kenny, Adrian Rich, Jerome Rothenberg, Margaret Atwood, Robert Coover, and our own William Gass represent only a small sampling of literary artists whose work has quickened our political and cultural consciousness at River Styx events since 1975. And we hope and trust our friends Mr. Breytenbach and Mr. Farah will feel at home in that context and in this room with all of us. But there is nothing routine about this evening or this time. The world and our country seem at a turning point. As Americans in the midst of a presidential campaign, the language of politics echoes, perhaps numbingly, in our heads. Too often it leaves out or even deadens the human spirit. It is important for our poets, novelists, essayists, to find the language of truth to engage and express this part of our reality. The participants in the conference are all artists who have made that effort and commitment. Bill Gass, the creative force behind the conference, conceives of its theme as having three parts to it: writers who have actively participated in politics, writers who have suffered from politics, and writers who profess, embody, or have a politics. I have the honor of introducing Brayton Breytenbach. He could be said to embody all three parts of this equation. He embodies a politics, participated in politics, and was jailed and suffered as a result of his politics. I first learned of Mr. Breytenbach from the American poet Jerome Rothenberg in 1975-76, who at the time was organizing a letter-writing campaign to protest Breytenbach's imprisonment in solitary confinement by the South African government for his active opposition to its apartheid policies. Mr. Breytenbach was born in Bonnyville, Cape Province, South Africa, on September 16, 1939. He began writing experimental poetry in Afrikaans while studying at the University of Cape Town. In 1959, he left South Africa for Europe, where he worked in temporary positions in England and France. And in 1961, he settled in France, which is where he now resides. Breytenbach became first known as a painter. His works were exhibited in Europe and America during his early years in Paris. Soon he became known for his writings too, winning the Afrikaans Prize in 1964 after publishing his first volume of poetry entitled The Iron Cow Must Sweat. His successes continued with subsequent efforts. He is the only South African to win the South African Central News Agency Award three times, for The House of the Deaf in 1967, Gangrene 1969, and Lotus in 1970. During this period, he tried to return to South Africa with his Vietnamese wife, but they were denied visas because of the interracial marriage, illegal under South African law. In 1973, the Breytenbachs were issued a three-month visa. This visit inspired Breytenbach's book, A Season in Paradise, which describes both a journey to his homeland and an interior journey into his own youth and upbringing. It's one of the books available here tonight in a book signing that will take place after both of our visiting artists have read. And Jane Ellen Iber of Poetry for the Halibut radio program on KDHX on Wednesday night is here to sell you the books. Breytenbach became a strong critic of apartheid, and in 1975 he returned clandestinely to South Africa to start a white branch of the African National Congress. He was captured and arrested under the Terrorist Act and spent the next 7 years in jail, the first two of which were in solitary confinement. This prison experience is dealt with extensively in The True Confessions of an Albino Terrorist, which I believe is the only other one of his books available in the United States and is here tonight as well. This book is a searing political and human indictment of the corrupt and corrupting apartheid regime, and a moving, brilliantly written bearing of a human soul. State of mind of the individual, the opponent, the other, under apartheid, and mind of state could be said to be its mirrored concerns. At the heart of the South African prison system, he writes in that book, is the denial of the humanity of the other. And in that, it is only a reflection of the larger South African cosmos. And the book provides countless examples of this dynamic in its multiple guises. Breytenbach's perspective is never political in the abstract, but always political in the human and humanizing impact. His prison experience serves to reinforce and reveal what he writes is the deeper need for showing tenderness or kindness to another human, and the firm human and political belief that, again, this is quoting him, man is born with the capacity and the imperative need to care for others. It's a great honor and pleasure to introduce to you Brayton Breytenbach.
Good evening. It's a bit daunting to be here and not knowing whom I'm going to read to, but it's also very exciting, exhilarating. Thank you for the welcome. It's also very, I'm impressed by that long and I would say nearly glorious list of people you mentioned who'd read here before, and I'm very honored to fall in line. You will hear after me Nureddin Farah, and I immediately want to say that wherever I falter tonight or what my weaknesses may be, please share it with Nureddin because we are here together. I'm going to read briefly from one published work which should be available or used to be available here in the States, and then some work that's not yet been published that I'll explain to you when I get there. But before getting there, I'm particularly happy to be able to read here because I'm very sensitive to what you said there about this being a community-based place. And it's good to get away from the formality of stages and lighting and all that and to be among real people. So, it's not a criticism because I think all things are necessary. But if I had my choice, this is where I want to be. The first, I'd like to start with a poem. Okay. I think we're going to take it in two parts. I'm going to go for about 40 minutes, and then Nuruddin will take over. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Right. So stop me when I get to my cutoff point. I'm going to start off with a poem that's published in a volume called Judas Eye. It was published here in the States by Farrar, Straussen, Giroux. And it's a collection of poems all written in prison. The original poems appeared after I was released from prison in various volumes in Afrikaans, and then we made a choice and I reworked them in English, and this comes from that volume. The poem is called Your Letter. And briefly, the background to that is that, as you've just heard, for the first 2 years I was in isolation in a prison in Pretoria. And that particular prison, which we call Maximum Security or Beverly Hills, is the hanging jail of South Africa. And once a week, the part of prison that I was in, one could hear the people who were going to be executed being taken up to the gallows. By the way, I must say it's something that really shocked me. I watched television the other night, and I saw an advertisement, or I suppose a spot you would call it, for the Democratic candidate Clinton, and, you know, to say why people should vote for him. And the second point was mentioned that he's for the death penalty. I thought it's absolutely horrendous that somebody should still say publicly that he's in favor of the death penalty. Anyway, this particular poem then refers to something which unfortunately was experienced by very many people there. It's temporarily been suspended. It's not been stopped in South Africa, but since the so-called negotiation started about 2 years ago, a gesture was made by the state authorities and they temporarily suspended the execution. There are quite a few hundred people waiting on death row at the moment, but for the moment the executions are not going on. So they used to come down the corridor next to my cell. And at about the same time, one of these occasions, I'd received a letter from my wife. Your letter is delightful. Larger and lighter than the thought of a flower when the dream is a garden. As your letter opens, there's an unfolding of sky, word from outside, wide spaces. I slept in green pastures. I lay on the reach of the valley of the shadow of death during the last watch of the night, listening to those condemned to die being led through tunnels in the earth, how they sing with the breath at their lips as residents at the point of leaving a city in flames, how they sing their breaths like shackles, how they sing, they who are about to jump from light into darkness, they who will be posted to no destination. Terror fills me at the desecration. The table before me in the presence of my enemies is bare. I have ash on my head. My cup is empty. And I fled to your letter to read of the orange tree decked out in white blossoms opening with the sun. I could smell it on the balcony. I can smell you, lovelier and lighter than the thought of a flower in this dismal night. I will be suspended from the sky of your words. Give that I may dwell in your letter all the days of my life. Your letter is wonderful, larger and lighter than the thought of a flower when the dream is the earth of a garden. As your letter opens, there's an unfolding of sky, word from outside, memory. The second poem is much more recent, and it's not yet been published. It refers to the events that took place in Addis Ababa a few years ago, what's it now, about a year and a half, 2 years, when the previous regime was overthrown. a few little references, perhaps, that need some explanation. I refer to somebody called the Ant, Mengistu Maria. Mariam I was told that the name in Amara actually means the little black ant, the ant. There's a reference to the Woyani. It's the name of the guerrillas who came into town, who took over Addis Ababa. And then there's a reference to the Mercato, which is the marketplace in Addis. And there's a reference to Ntoto or Toto. Toto is the name of the highest hill in Addis Ababa. It's also the name of a lion that was kept, the last one that was kept alive in some cages in the gardens of the royal palace. And that's what started off the old poem, a photo of this emaciated lion sitting behind bars towards the end of the takeover. It's called Revelation. The ant took flight. For a long time, the war was a rumor growling beyond the desert's mysteries. Further than skylines where the sun burns black, an army of youths vanished to figure out a frontier. But soon the garrison outposts were encircled one by one. The capital's lifeline to the sea was cut, and black skeletons became specks before the eye of the onlookers taking sight for too long. When all about the night suddenly spat fiery tongues and famished deserters in the outskirts started trading boots and guns, then the ant, clad in his blue comrade's tunic, fled southwards. As relieved orphans, we pushed from the pedestals the images of a foreign all-knowing thought and tore the idolatrous portraits from the walls to stamp them out. When all at once the barbarians were among us, bashful Woyani in sneakers and dirty coils of cloth around the dreadlocks, or again with the lion's crest of conquerors from the wilderness, as of old high stepping through history to curdle the blood. At the crossroads, military vehicles, silenced by the manifold gray colors of sand, took up position, their heavy weapons pointing to the four houses of breath. First they took over the Mercato. The wireless started prompting in an accent unfamiliar to us deeper from the desert past, like bird song. Our stray soldiers with the chopped off feet and all the twittering secretaries from our middle empire still fattened to a shine on hoarded food, their suitcases stuffed with clean pajamas and exculpatory secret files, were herded together and fenced in camps to be marked. A few comrade commanders committed suicide. Harlots washed the scarlet stigmata of bartered love from their faces, and the city became a bell tolling silence with the muted stammering of speculation behind walls hovering on the inaudible. And at times, the crack and death shout of a former torture artist summarily dispatched in a dark alley. Hard on daybreak, on the other side of the bulwarks, the fireworks of yet another exploding ammunition dump would flower. We asked ourselves if this was the archangel of death, or perhaps the new democracy. A revolutionary march by a flames chattered hungry for news through the roofs of shacks. Under cover of a reddened dusk, we heard hyenas scuff. In the morning, we climbed the black scorched hilltops with eucalyptus leaves in the nostrils to confuse the giddy smell of rotting corpses. We stuffed veils in our mouths to hide the wailing. For a long time, we poked among the spent mortar shells and twisted metal to look for a remembered identity. This here was a picture. New flower, thus our city was called, a labyrinth of whispers high above the sea's mirror. New directives in desert language started staining the walls. In public squares, new effigies of the masses were hoisted to their feet, but with the same omniscient eyes and flowing hair of old. In courtyards of prayer places, bearded bishops with mitres swung incense to yammer hymns about peace, and Solomon's seed coming to nest dove-like in Sheba's gorge. Old men listened, leaning on cleft sticks, wrapped in shrouds. Flies, like ancient blood, brought the movement of life to the lips. Young men kissed the sanctified walls and doorposts and the banners, and later with damp cheeks also the conqueror's hands. Survival is a rip-off of the past. On the palace gates the seals were broken. The infinity of halls and corridors now only repeated the echo of beaten footsteps. Dark murals immortalized the ant leading myriads of believers against heathen and heretic and capitalist. The heart chamber of control had wall maps with flyshit of multicolored thumbtacks spelling out the strategy of resistance and victory. Here each general's chair had a red hammer and sickle on the back, portraits of the hyena. On the floor there was a shifting desert, an hourglass, where the miniature enemies were to be buried under historical determinism, just like imagination or memory. And below iron doors, cloistered in the earth, the emperors lay each in his singular cradle, clothed in the dusty sleep of ages, their fingers burnt out candles. An innermost court, here the empire's spindly talisman waited behind bars. Entoto, last of the royal lines, named after our highest heel, smells powder and ashes and the meat gone bad, and in his eyes, as yellow as fires of glass, he tries to catch one final glimpse of that distant, lead-stained desert silence. Now, I'd like to read to you from a book that's going to be published in the coming spring here in the States by Harcourt, Brace, and Jovanovic. It's a book called Return to Paradise with a subtitle An African Journal, and it describes a three-month visit that I made with my wife to South Africa last year, all the memories that that brought back, all the experiences we had, and there are also many flashbacks to other experiences and memories of other parts of Africa. I'll read to you one chapter. It concerns the death of my father. It's a little bit different from the rest of the book, but it's something which I think could perhaps come across in the effort of reading it publicly. Don't be worried about all the many names that may come up that you don't know. They would be either my wife or my father or my brothers or a close friend of mine called Slabbert who accompanied me on part of the journey. It's called Guide, the chapter, and it starts with an evocation of place names in South Africa. This is the way we came, from where the Popognani falls thunder above the Hoho Valley, in the distance the purple Litombo, and closer Kobolondo or Gato Kober, which means ass over kettle, through Mhlambanyatsi and Bunya to the Nurston border crossing, then Amsterdam, Pietrieptief, Hondkop to the left, Komandlam Pangpisi, Wachebiki, which means wait a while, Wakkerstroom and Volksrust with the glorious battle hill of Majuba on the horizon not far from Lüneburg and Hamburg, and General Joubert's grave in the shadow of a Sammelberg, which means gather mountain, on to Friede, P. peace, not for long. Jakalskop, Leeuwkop, Roadside, Kalkop, Bramkop, which means Adderhead, Skeinswuchte, Warden, Via Kreispad to Bethlehem, Slabbats, far in the distance, Mount Horeb, Furiesburg, Appelkurskop, Apricot Hill, and Wonderkop, Kommandoneck, Vicksburg, glancing right to the killing fields of Spionkop and Verkop, Eerstekamp, Modderpoort, Mudgate, Gethsemane lies over the mountain frontier in Lesotho, Marseille, Faust, Tabapatswa, Kumisipoort, Hophouse, Sorry Passage, and off to the right, Skituk, Wildehondekop, Kafferskop, Weppene, Elandsberg, Zastron, Mount Vulture, Mount Mercy, Dancers and Winners, Al Railway Signings, Houtkop, Ruwel, Biesterkraalneck, Aliwal North, Jamestown, with the way to either side, Swainpoort, and Preacher's Heel. Laughing Water, across Stormberg, direction Molteno to Seifergat, Garrickmore, Busmanhoekpas, Malabarsberg, Sterkstrom to Queenstown. Over the Black Kai, Goshen left, Katberg, Old Times, Fort Beaufort, Kunapswuchte, Grahamstown. Father, it was your winter of 1989 and it was cold. We drove the whole day long, Slabbert and I, in his white Mercedes. We had to. This was the only way it could be done. Yolande and I had been to a conference at Victoria Falls, a gathering of ANC exiled scribblers and young writers from inside. We always spoke of South Africa as inside, as opposed to the out here of elsewhere. The meeting came to within a whisker of being blown up on the last night. We separated to return to our respective nests. She and I spent some time in Harare before flying on to Swaziland, where we arrived without visas. We had applied for permission to be allowed to visit you in Grahamstown. We hadn't seen you since that one fleeting afternoon in 1986 when we carried you outside on the lawn under the trees of Rachel's garden. How cruel these Boere are. Why the petty hatred, the harshness, the vindictiveness? I thought about it a lot as we drove down the country over a map of names marking the dreams and sorrows of pioneers and settlers. I could read the land, the resting places of the tongue, the intimate symbiosis between shape and sound encapsulating a vision of a battle fort or a vantage point or a narrow gap in the cliffs or a hole sunk for water. Could people have been so close to beauty and death under storms of sun and winds of stars and produced degenerate descendants crossing off lives with a stroke of the pen behind their desks of state? This was not what you taught me. Were they punishing me and us for the uncomfortable things I said at Pretoria State Theatre in 1986 when they allowed me back into the country together with my non-white wife for a few weeks? Was it in retaliation for the enthusiastic reception we received during the same trip, one rainy evening at the Coloured University of Western Cape? But it was not, is not, their country. The state may be theirs, this carnivorous cyst of moral malady, this abortion of infamy and greed. The country was always ours. And they knew only too well that I was no longer involved in any subversive activities? Or is the cause of justice always a threat to tyrants? Rachel had written that you were growing old, weakening. I applied for permission to come and see you. For so long, our lives had been torn apart. How I wished to sit at your feet once more to comfort you. It was 1987. The interior minister of the time who handled the request was a drunkard from Natal, Slopmouth Boota. This is what then happened. My sister only told me this much later. Two security dogs were sent to the hospital where you lay, an old, exhausted man in his 80s, to interrogate you. And when they could elicit no statement from you, how could they? You could no longer speak. Did they twist your paralyzed arm? They rummaged through your bed locker and those of the other old men in the ward as well. And Slotnath made a statement to the press to say, my application had been turned down because your condition did not justify it. Although he cynically expressed compassion and because I was a security threat. I wrote him an open letter. You know well enough. And the paranoid monsters with the short hair and the chewing gum thoughts who whisper in your ear ought to know that my wife and I only intended a family visit to my father. Keep your drooling sympathy to yourself. There used to be a time when Afrikaners respected the aged and the weak. There was a time, despite the planned injustice perpetrated against the majority of our compatriots, then already, when the Afrikaner could still walk upright and look his neighbor in the eye without too much shame. It has long since passed. What do we care about the tear on your cheek and the trembling of your finger when you pull the trigger again and again? My own case is of minute importance. I am only one among thousands in a similar or worse situation. We are the dwarfs, but we are the immense majority. We see what we see, even if your sophists try to cover up reality. We count the deads. We know who make the power decisions, your police counselors and your military experts. We observe how you pretend to be holding free elections under state of emergency, whilst eavesdropping on one another and stabbing each other in the back. We know of your occupation troops in the black townships, of the children in your jails, of your murderous expeditions across the border. You have degraded into implements of murder. You may pull the wool over God's eyes, but the people will not be fooled. You stand in a dock of history with blood-besmirched hands, and some of the blood comes from your own people. I wonder if ever you were to find yourself in hospital one day, old and lame, whether your son will want to come and visit you. Outrageous words, Father. I was bitter. In 1988, the Western Cape University conferred an honorary degree upon me. Again I tried to enter. Again I was rebuffed. This time, Slubbert interceded with foreign affairs. I believe the matter was discussed at cabinet level. We were offered a deal. Allowed into the country for 4 days, we would have to enter and leave via Swaziland and make our way by air from Swaziland to Johannesburg for the connecting flight out. Not make use of internal flights, but stay on the roads, and it was to be a private family visit only, with no contact with anybody else. I threatened to go public with these impossible restrictions. Slubbert, tireless and loyal, negotiated some more on our behalf, and it was granted that we could drive back to Johannesburg and leave from there. We'd have to report at a given door and time to be received and shipped out by someone from Foreign Affairs. We finally obtained our visas, stipulating clearly the purpose of our visit in a fortified consulate in Manzini, and had to trace the route we intended taking on a map. It's a long way from Swaziland to Grahamstown. We took turns driving. The country was heartbreakingly beautiful. How much it eats me when I'm not there. It's the heritage you left me, an inner presence, the sliding distance to which I belong, the reverberations etching my dreams. We decided that it would be too tiring for Yolande to make the trip, too saddening as well. She and Jane were to go directly to Johannesburg and wait for us there. By the time we reached Elandsburg, our beer was finished. We ate our sandwiches under a tree. Some fields had been freshly plowed. There were shades and colors of silence. On and on through a changing land and the shifting clouds, an unfolding of history. We spent the first night in a hotel in Aliwal North. It had started to rain. The soup and the television were equally bad. The owners didn't recognize us. From Jamestown on, we were driving in the snow. The windmills, the dams, the roofs, the hedges and the trees were all coated white. Substance drained from the land with a fading of ink. White sheep stood huddled and still in virgin fields. This was a rare sight. The pass over the Stormberger was closed to traffic by a red-nosed policeman, and we had to turn right and descend towards Multino. We entered or crossed the Siskai at some stage, and the rural poverty was evident. The fell browsed bear, cattle bunching under the road fences, against the road fences for a nibble of grass through the wire. And this used to be fertile land, Slabbert explained. It's the arbitrary concentration of people which destroys the environment and dislocates the communities. Tiny dwellings were scattered over the hills. They were often painted green as if with some leftover suburban swimming pool coating. We snaked along the contours and over the ancient mountain shapes of the Katberg Pass. A good gravel road through a bare but impressive pattern of untouched territory, not a soul in sight. There was no snow now, just a cold wind, and switched back down its more wooded southern slopes to stop for lunch in the hotel at its foot. A fire crackled in a fireplace, and we allowed ourselves a good bottle of wine. It was late afternoon by the time we reached Grahamstown. Rachel took me to the hospital to see you. I think she'd prepared you beforehand. You smiled, your crooked smile. Your eyes were as dark as ever. Your dead hand was covered by the jersey over your shoulders. You tried to speak your non-language, asked about Butterfly Smile, my wife, wanted to know how I got there, wanted to know and say so many things. I took out and showed you the warm presents she'd sent along. I held your good hand. What could I tell you about France or Berlin or Zimbabwe? You listened like somebody who would never judge again. That night, André Brink and his wife Marisa came for supper. A cold mist swirled outside. We drank and talked late into the night. Rachel took me shopping the next morning. I bought a pair of red shoes with white laces. Then it was time. It was time to say goodbye, Father. You were sitting upright in your bed when we arrived. You knew. Your eyes clung to my face. Was it true? Did you want to go home? Were you afraid of the door? There's no home anymore. I tried to explain, to smile and laugh. I promised that I'll be back soon. We were going to take you out of here, remember? We were going to return you to the farm, Father. You still had to show me how to milk cows. You took my hand with your good one, this one which I'm using now, and laid it flat next to yours on a blanket. You looked at our two hands for the long moment of a lifetime, as if comparing, and you shook your head sadly. What were you saying? That it's been so long since you felt the sun on your skin, that you would never work again, that your hand has let you down. I have your hands, Father. Then it was time. I kissed your lips and walked away. I couldn't take it. Rachel stayed behind for a while. Outside the door of the ward, I stopped and looked back. You were weeping in total abandon. I remember the greyness of the tears, the wetness of your cheeks. I'd never seen you cry like that. Adelaide, Bedford, Dachaboohook, Craddock, Rooiberg, Doringberg, Hofmeyr, Teerbus and Koffiebus, Venterstad, Norwalspont, Donkerpoort, Springfontein, Van Zylrivier, the Battle of Boomplaats, buried in time off to our left, Pompey, Karlsbruit, Bloemfontein. We spent a night in Bloemfontein. Darkness, Lumsden's Horse, Kierumsberg, Brandfort, Houtenbeck, Chateaumouth, Mossiwani, Vetrivier, Tunissen, Maribakop, Rebelkop, Ventersburg, Geneva, Holfontein, Principal, and far to one side, Solitary Hill. In the distance, Mirage, Gun Hill, Kronstadt, Jordan, the False River, America to the right, then Verbetering, Red Wall, Greenlands, Passy, Kristallkop, Vondihevel, Frederfort, Paris, Vals, Sebokeng, and Johannesburg. Our 4 days were up. Yolande and I were now illegally in the country. In the evening, we made a fire in Slabbert and Jane's house and watched television. A newsreader announced that the Minister of the Interior, Slopmath Buerta, had decided to grant us visas on humanitarian grounds, and we were due soon in the country. On the late night news, another journalist corrected the bulletin by saying that we'd already been and left. We had lunch outside the next day. It was a sunny and dry, heartfelt winter's day, together with the Slabberts, Andres Sow, Suzanne Fox, Moons, and Greta, Marty, and Hetty, and Jonna, and Elsa, and Gerrit Ollefeyer. Somebody tried stealing John's bucky the night before. Slabbert took us to Jan Smuts Airport. A well-mannered, French-speaking gentleman took us in his charge. He pretended hard not to be from National Intelligence. We were offered coffee or beer. This was a secluded part of the airport building with no other passengers in sight. We sat back on a luxury sofa and chatted. Somebody came to fetch our passports. Another person took care of our luggage. National Intelligence shook our hands and gave us over in the care of an elderly body who escorted us discreetly onto the plane. Then it came to pass. My sister called early one morning, December 1989, hoar frost on the balcony outside. Yolande was remarking that the sparrows had been to eat all the crusts, all the crumbs. You had died, Father. When it was too cold for me to stay awake. In what mirror did I lose my face? I went walking through the park, crystals on the leaves, people's faces like small steam engines. When I was small, before Mother ladled out to soup in the evening, you taught us about folding our hands and closing our eyes. I remember the rhythm, but not the words. Your one leg had become gangrenous. We call it cold fire in Afrikaans. The doctor decided to amputate yesterday. You woke up when it was still dark. They'd taken away your glasses and your teeth, our Father, and you saw that the leg was gone. And you turned your head to the wall and sighed. White is the wall, warm with sun. Suddenly there will be no new yesterdays. Death is when one has used up all one's yesterdays. Thoughts hurt my head. There's a story of the trout caught with the neck hair of a cock twisted into a fly. A fly is knowledge. Our Father, you have moved. You are swimming like a trout in a dark grave without walls. I thought, death must be like sleeping as fast as a fishing line without a hook. The raven in my chest was spreading its wings, pecking at my throat. Rachel called to say they'd taken you to Port Elizabeth for cremation. I flew down from cold, white Europe. Pluto waited for me at the airport. We drove to Amanus, golden summer morning, breeze off the sea. We were early, went for tea. The cafe owner told us a story of how he was out at sea on a boat once to help scatter the ashes of a deceased friend on the waters, and then the wind had turned. When we arrived at the church, the others were there, Jan and wife, Rachel and daughter, one of Kluter's wives and his children, Jan Boltung and Jabri. Rachel carried a small casket of beautiful brown wood. She handed it to me. "Now you can hold Father for a while," she said. "Your ashes. I was holding you in my hands, so light, like burnt-out fire. I wondered about the leg." Rachel told of how Brother Jan talked until late last night, all his memories of you poured out, and today in the car he sang all the way here. At the last moment, our youngest brother walked in, Bastian Bier, the one you loved the most. He moved into the bench next to me, smelling of liquor. His hands trembled. He was wearing dark glasses. He didn't want us to see him crying. Christo Arlite led the service, my old buddy from school days in Wellington. How many times we used to roam the streets at night to steal fruit from the neighbors' trees, to start all the dogs barking, to run with the stars. He spoke of you as Wim Hannes, Christo's old man. His father was the parson of our congregation when we were young. He was at the back of the church now, bent and gray. He finished the service with a moving prayer to some deity up there where the mind cannot reach. I went to shake his hand. "And so you haven't lost a faith?" he asked. it would have been too long a story. We drove to the cemetery and walked up to where Onoi, my mother, lies buried under the fluttering of butterflies and the twittering of birds. Jan was holding the casket awkwardly. The wind lifted the hair off his forehead. Somebody had to say something. Jan cleared his throat, said, "At least now Oboas and Onoi are together again," broke off, looked away, silence, sun. But the crust over the grave was too solid. Somebody was going to have to return later to make a hole. And in the evening, we all gathered in an Italian restaurant in Cape Town for a meal around a long table. All your descendants of difficult sons and daughter and grandchildren. I missed Jolan's quiet hand in mine. Jan expounded his beliefs for the preservation of elephants in Africa. They're landscape gardeners, he said, breaking down the dense vegetation to make it possible, for other species to live. Afterwards, I walked down towards Kluter's flat in town where I was to sleep. Wind was curling white over the mountain. You'd been my guide, Oba's father, my initiator, my elephant. My deepest yesterdays had been colored by you. When I was very small, do you remember? And we walked home at night, you carried me on your shoulders. Your shoulders were a ship. I felt your rough cheeks under my palms. I could reach up and pluck the swinging stars. This I wanted to write you tonight, now that we've been to visit the fragrant places where your footprints may still linger for all we know. Ash is the memory of fire, the slow and separated wings. But the flame never dies. It moves on to become a guiding star. Thank you.